Alan Kring Productions, in association with the Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is International Financial Management, FIL 344, for spring semester 2022.
Today, purchasing power parity theory and applications. The subject is a little bit, you kind of look at it and you say, is that all there is to this? Yeah, it is about this straightforward. This isn't rocket science. If you get into a PhD program, you get into theoretical mathematical stuff and all that. That's not what we do in an undergrad course. This is pretty straightforward stuff. I wanted to start you off, however, with some of the geopolitics that's going on and its impact on international finance, exchange rates, and how this is going to affect what happens as far as future, the near-term future goes and your prospects of getting drafted into a war in Eastern Europe. Postcards, please. I'd appreciate that. But I want you to notice something. Okay, here, look at the chart. I'm going to take you through some of the exchange rates. Look at the chart. Here's the Great British Pound. Okay, you see this tailing off. Okay, let's look at the euro. Okay. And, of course, let's have a look at the ruble. We're getting to a point where, I mean, we're going to run out of decimal places for the ruble here. But that's important for us to mention it in a minute here. Now, let's look at the yen. What is going on? Do you notice that the pattern is the same across these currencies? So what's happening here? Are they all appreciating against the dollar, or are they all depreciating against the dollar? Now remember, these are direct quotes. So what do you say? Are they, for example, the yen was at 0.0087 to the one yen could buy $0.0087, and now 1 yen can buy about $0.0052. So is the yen appreciating or depreciating? Depreciating. And this is across the board. This is happening. Now that's interesting, because you're going to see another thing going on here when we do purchasing power parity. And we look at the absolute PPP and the relative PPP. This tells us something that's going on there. But there's also something else. Remember the equation, and let me put that up on the board here, if I can remember all of its terms in order. The foreign exchange rate would be a function of changes in inflation. I don't remember if I'm putting these in interest rates, in, government controls and income. Geez, I could not remember income. God, I've been out away too long. And then changes in government controls and changes in, yes, the expectations. Could not remember the change in income. Okay, so, I mean, this would not be delta income, probably. I mean, this is happening too fast for an income effect. Income effect is a slower process. Probably government controls are involved, but that would be an explanation for the ruble. That would not be an explanation for the other currencies. And a change in expectations, well, what the heck are the expectations that are causing all of these currencies to depreciate against the good old American currency? The issue would probably be interest rates. It would probably. Now, it could be change in inflation, but we're having inflation is definitely a problem. But that would be that would seem to cause the foreign currencies to appreciate if our inflation rate is worse than theirs. This should probably be a change in interest rates. The Federal Reserve has been pushing interest rates up. I believe that there's one right on deck right now that's happening. And so what this tells me is that this is an interest rate effect going on. Our interest rates are getting stronger, So our currency appreciates against other currencies. The price of a dollar is an interest rate in the United States, a U.S. interest rate. Therefore, if our U.S. interest rates go up relative to other countries' interest rates, that makes our dollar stronger than theirs, and that, of course, has all kinds of implications. That means that our exports become more expensive and all that. Go ahead. Absolutely. Absolutely. We are definitely, the U.S. is, despite the breathlessness, and I don't want to take any, pro-Biden or anything like that position, but the world is actually appreciative that we aren't raging in there and just going to war immediately. In other words, we're being leaders, and leaders wait for the right opportunity for any kind of a battle, any kind of an engagement. On this subject, sitting with my old Army friend yesterday, we were having awfully strong coffee and vape juice and talking about, but did you see that one? And we were talking about the videos, enjoying watching Russian tanks being destroyed. And we were both agreeing that the photograph of the little girl with the rifle using a lollipop while waiting to kill Russians was just delicious. But the reality of it is that they hit a base very close to the Polish border. And I said, if one piece of that shrapnel went over the borderline, and before I could even finish it, he said Article 5. And in other words, Article 5 is we go in there with our fangs out and all of our firepower just destroying everything in our path. We didn't do it because we couldn't find any evidence that it hit over the border. That's leadership. Control yourself. Wait until you see the whites of their eyes and all that kind of stuff. Okay? So, the world is, there is that going on. There is no question that the capitals of the free world are just sitting back saying, yeah, we're going to do it. You just let us know when it's time if we have to do it. That makes our currency strong, okay? The shining beacon of liberty and all of that that you guys were told we shouldn't talk about, American exceptionalism, it's real. And you can see it in these exchange rates. That's a big thing right there. The interest rates and the strength of the American dollar representing the strength of the American way of leading us, leading NATO in this mess and dealing with it. I want to show you an interesting thing here. Let me take you to the yuan. Plunging too. And we're going to see how that plays out because China was making inappropriate remarks about maybe we could help with some war material and all that, to which I respond, really? You want the Russians to go into combat with made-in-China crap? But I shouldn't say that. Yes, I should. Okay, but the truth of the matter is that China is weakening against the dollar, too. China's leadership of the world fantasies just ain't going to happen because they can't get their act together and say resolutely, no, this is wrong. Do not do this. We're going to stay out of it. But they still have fantasies of attacking Taiwan, which they will eventually. But there you go. You can see that the U.S. dollar is strong. Yay, America. We're all here and we're the leaders. The bad news is that means we are the leaders. Okay. Now, taking that all in context, though, the important one is the delta INT for this. Now, purchasing power parity. I had snuck that in on you a while back with a more or less this assuming the law of one price. That, in other words, assuming that there is one price across the globe for a product, for a good, for a service, whatever. There is one price. And therefore, the exchange rate should align with this one price law, purchasing power parity. Now, that is actually called absolute purchasing power parity. The exchange rate will hold. Now, I'm going to show you an equation that looks suspiciously the same as an equation that I have written on the board several times. This darned equation just keeps showing up in finance, in international finance especially. But not just in international finance. It shows up in all kinds of ways in all kinds of finance, including derivatives, as I had mentioned before. But the exchange, foreign exchange rate should be 1 plus the home interest rate over 1 plus the foreign, let me start with the inflation. The book starts with the inflation one. 1 plus the home inflation rate divided by 1 plus the foreign inflation rate minus 1. Did I write an F there? Jeez. Yeah, that's right. Minus 1. Now, you saw this earlier. It just keeps showing up, this ratio of relative interest rate or inflation rate, whatever you want to call it. You'll see it again in a while when we write it, as I was about to before. The foreign exchange, this is from the foreign perspective, inflation, 1 plus the home interest rate over 1 plus the foreign interest rate, minus 1. In other words, exchange rates are actually like a premium. All they do is create the balance between two countries' inflation rates or two countries' interest rates. It's like the exchange rate is sort of like the regulator that keeps everything in line. Now, this kind of Fisher effect just seems to keep showing up all kinds of places where we look at the world in terms of differences as premiums. Or discounts. I mean, in the top one, if our interest inflation rate is lower than a foreign inflation rate, then the exchange rate will go down. If our interest rate is lower than a foreign country's interest rate, the exchange rate will go down. But then you can take it the other way. No matter how you look at this, though, it's arguing that Now, this takes you into a little bit higher level material, which, I mean, 20 years ago, I would have talked more about this, but we don't do the physics and mathematics background in business programs we used to, but this is actually an equilibrium condition. In other words, in equilibrium, this is what we should see. That does not mean that we are in equilibrium at any given moment. In fact, that's the whole point of arbitrage, is to find disequilibrium and take advantage of it, which drives us back to equilibrium. However, this is an equilibrium condition, and this is absolute purchasing power parity. Now, there's another one called relative purchasing power parity, which would argue that the exchange rate, the actual exchange rate, won't be this equation. But the changes in the exchange rate will be equilibrium oriented. In other words, the exchange rate might be something, and then if the one plus interest rate home over one plus the interest rate foreign minus one changes, then the exchange rate will follow that change. In other words, if one plus 0.03 over 1 plus 0.02 minus 1. Let's say that our inflation rate foreign, our inflation rate is 3%. The foreign inflation rate is 2%. 1.03 over 1.02 minus 1. God, I'm so bad at math. I used to be able to do this in my head. Now I can't. 1.03 divided by 1.02 minus 1. Let me take that to the negative first power. 102 on the 100. And that the changes in this one, 0.03 over 0.02, will hold that value right there. It will hold that value. I do that even right, but yeah. So that's relative purchasing power parity. In other words, you will not see the market basket of goods in China and the market basket of goods in the United States being equivalent relative to the exchange rate. But if that market basket of goods goes up by, let's say, 3%, 2% in a foreign country, in China, and it goes up by 2%, it will go up by 2% here because the exchange rate will hold. That's relative PPP. It might not be right. The purchasing power parity might not be absolute. But when it changes in one country, it will change. The exchange rate will reflect that change in the other country. Now, I'll have to say that a few times today and tomorrow for it to actually make sense even to me. But just know that what's the truth of the matter? The data is pretty clear that the relative purchasing power parity is valid. That is an equilibrium condition. Yeah.
So you're showing us that 1 and 2, you're saying so if the 2% inflation in a foreign country is up by 2%,
so it would
go up to like 0.04 or something, then the top.
Would go 1 plus 0.06. Okay, to hold the exchange rate. Or if it doesn't, if it stays the same at 0.03, then the exchange rate will reflect the, what was that, 0.02 to 0.04, yeah, 100% increase, then the exchange rate will reflect the 100% change. We might not necessarily have our inflation rate go up by the same as China's, but the exchange rate will reflect the relative change in the two interest rates, or the two inflation rates, or whatever you want to talk about. Now, the only thing that is a little bit of a flaw in this, a little bit of a difficulty, is the delta GC. Government controls are hard to measure. I mean, what is that? A 2% increase in government controls in one country? Well, you know, we can liquidate it down to value in terms of cost of goods. But there's that. Now, I want to take you on another little part of the journey. The law of one price is sort of a rock-solid assumption that comes to us clear back from neoclassical economic theory. I mean, it's a long time. We've held this law of one price. And we know that it's not correct, but we know why it's not correct. Again, the law of one price. The same good should be the same price across the world in every market. Okay. However, that's not true. And there are reasons why it's not true. And that impacts on exchange rates. You could have a good that does not have close substitutes in another country. In one country, it is an abundant. In another country, it might not be abundant. And therefore, you have a major permanent disequilibrium in exchange rates because of this. The argument the neoclassicists would give you is that ultimately, that good that has no close substitutes in a country would eventually have close substitutes. If a country is in that bad a shape that it does not have a good, and it has to import that good from other places, ultimately it will find a way to produce that good. Perhaps not a comparative advantage, but it will find a way to do it. Is that possible? Well, that would be a very long term. And it's also, there are reasons why that can't happen. For example, mineral deposits. There are some countries that just have a lot of something, and there are other countries that just don't have it. It's not there. And they will never have it. And so the law of one price will never hold because there is not that good at a certain price in another country. That's just the reality of it. Where do we see that? All over the world we see that, for one thing right now. And this is where the neoclassicists would say, and this is where a real old-time conservative would kind of come into play. Yes, oil. We have a disequilibrium because Russia has a shit ton of oil that it pipes out, and natural gas that is not available in other parts of the world in that abundance. Okay, well, what does that mean to a classical economist? Well, because it is such a problem for us, eventually we will find a substitute for it, alternate energy sources. And the more severe the law of one price is violated in the short run, the more urgent and more quickly a country that does not have that resource will find a substitute for it. So, bitching about the gas prices now, and I will as well as anyone else, on the other hand, yeah, all that's going to do is induce us to start getting cracking on damn alternatives. In fact, if you will read the news, and I don't know how well you follow the news, but eventually you're going to follow it as informed citizens. All of a sudden, all this news is coming out about fusion reactors. We have reached break even. We have sustained break even for several minutes, blah, blah, blah. We've been working on fusion since I was a boy talking about it. But all of a sudden, well, spank me Jesus, now we're getting cracking on it. We're going to have fusion reactors. And once we have those, well, that energy problem just kind of goes away like the shining sun on a beautiful morning. Using a rather direct metaphor here. You see, that's the point, though, is that disequilibriums can exist. The likely cause of a disequilibrium that violates these equations right here, the purchasing power parity theories, absolute or relative, is simply because the law of one price isn't in play, but in the long run, it will find a way to get in line, one way or the other. What does that mean for international finance, for people like us? We live in the short run. As John Maynard Keynes said, in the long run, we're all dead. However, if we look at a longer-term perspective, you can say we have problems and we have to deal with our short-run problems with exchange rates and predicting their movement and how we hedge those movements. But in the long run, it'll fix itself. As long as we stay with a capitalist system or something that is reasonably capitalist, we'll be okay. But that, of course, doesn't help us in the short run. Let me show you something here. These graphics, a version of these graphics, I should say, are in the PowerPoint for Chapter 8, and I've just sort of sharpened them up for you a little bit, tuned them up. But, oh, let me show you something here. A kind of consequence of this, and I'm going to just use an I to represent inflation, interest rates, income, is that approximately, the foreign exchange rate will be the I, whichever one it is, home, minus the I, whichever one it is, foreign. Approximately. In other words, this equation or these equations approximate this behavior. Let me explain this to you from FIL 240. You remember the one where the risk-free rate equals the real rate plus the expected inflation premium. If you were in my class, I probably brought it up to you that this is actually technically not correct. The actual equation is that the risk-free rate equals 1 plus the real rate times 1 plus the expected inflation premium minus 1. That's technically the right way to do it. It's called generically the Fisher effect. So in other words, if R sub real is 3% and the expected inflation premium is 2%, then the cheapo way to do it would be to say that the risk-free rate, this is the nominal rate, is equal to 3% plus 2%, which equals 5%. Okay? That's how I teach it in FIL 240. Technically, that's not exactly right. Because of the compounding effect, it is technically 1 plus 0.03 times 1 plus 0.02 minus 1, which equals, and of course I killed the calculator before I was finished with it, 1.03 times 1.02 minus 1, 5.06. And you're saying, well, big whoop-de-doo. Exactly. Only when one of the, or both of the numbers are kind of big, does that technically right formula come into play. That's what I'm doing over here. This is the Fisher effect way of doing it. This is the FIL 240 way of doing it. But it's actually very close to being right. That's why I can do this for a lot of the foreign exchange rate problems instead of the technically correct way of doing it here. Taking you off that, let me finish this. The nominal is the
real plus the inflation expectation. That's the 240 way, the sloppy way, the way we usually do it. And I mean, there are some places where you have to do it that way, like in forward rates and all that. But because the difference between this way and the cheaper way is so minimal in most circumstances, we'll do it the Fisher effect way. Now, let me turn that equation around here. Nominal equals real plus expected inflation. Okay, now, let me take this and turn it around. The book and the PowerPoints make a really big thing about this. And I'm not sure that it is really all that much of a big thing to talk about. But it does give us a kind of an insight. The nominal minus the inflation rate will equal the real rate. If you write it that way, it looks suspiciously like this. Now, again, we're not using the Fisher effect way. We're just using the simple way. But if you look at it, if I turn this simple, obvious thing, nominal equals real plus inflation, if I turn it around, it looks so damn much like this that it's kind of disturbing. What does that mean? Quite honestly, hell, I don't know. But like I said, the book makes a big thing out of it. I'm not going to make a huge thing out of it myself here, and I certainly wouldn't on an exam. But the truth of the matter is that a foreign exchange rate should be driven by the nominal minus the inflation rate in the two countries relative to each other. So in other words, the exchange rate, if you looked at it, should be driven by how high the observed nominal interest rates are in the two countries, minus the expectation of inflation relative in the two countries. In other words, this is a relative purchasing power parity phenomenon. Let me show you what it means in practice. I'm going to try to pull these up. And I'm being a little scattered in my lecture here. I'll go back to this. This would be purchasing power parity. Perfect. Purchasing power parity. Change in a relative. Okay, so, in other words, if there is a percent change in the currency's spot rate, that should be associated with a 2% change, for example, in the purchasing power when buying foreign goods. So, in other words, if the euro goes up by 2% against the dollar in exchange rate, then that means that the foreign exchange rate should go up by exactly 2%. Let me say that another way. Let me give you another example. So, for example, if, as point B shows you, if the foreign exchange spot rate declines by 5%, that should be attended by a 5% decline in purchasing power when buying foreign goods. Okay?
Now, look at C. C is a disequilibrium situation. The foreign currency spot rate, let's say, goes up by 1%. That should lead to a 1% increase in purchasing power when buying the foreign goods. But there could be a disequilibrium. Suppose that instead there's a 4% increase in the purchasing power of foreign goods. Well, how would that fix itself? If we had a disequilibrium like C, what would happen? Well, we have a 4% increase in the difference between the purchasing inflation rate in the home currency versus the foreign currency. A 4% increase. But we have only a 1% change in the foreign exchange rate. Well, what that would do is that would induce the purchase of foreign goods. Demand for the foreign currency would go up. So this would drive us to point A on the line. Let me say that again. And if I say it enough times, you'll actually kind of make sense. Suppose that the foreign currency has gone up by only 1%. That would be this place right here. But purchasing power when buying foreign goods has gone up by 4%. We can buy a hell of a lot more. Well, we're going to then. But in order to buy a foreign product, we would have to buy the foreign currency to do it. As we bought the foreign currency, that would drive the foreign exchange rate toward appreciation of the foreign currency. And I do appreciate that this takes a while for this to sort of soak in. But the disequilibriums would fix themselves if they could. Now let's look at another one, just to see if we can get this to the point where it makes sense. Suppose that the foreign currency declined by 2%. Well, that should induce a 2% decline in the purchasing power of that currency. But instead, it created a 3% reduction in purchasing power. Well, that would mean that we would stop buying those foreign goods, and that would drive the exchange rate backward until we had equilibrium again. This is that equation right there, essentially. In other words, I sub H minus I sub F, inflation or interest rate or whatever you want to talk about in the home currency is above has gone up against the foreign inflation rate or interest rate. Well, that should induce a change in the exchange rate pushing up the foreign currency against the domestic currency. And if it doesn't, ultimately that will cause demand for the foreign currency to increase, which will cause the exchange rate that will cause the demand for the foreign currency to decline, which will cause the exchange rate to adjust downward. Like I said, this is an equilibrium kind of thing. It's a real nasty twist on what you would have been taught in microeconomics. And I won't beat it over the head too hard for the time being. It's not worth the aggravation for any of us. But I do want to point out something. Let me take you back to this equation. And I'm going to just do something real quick with it.
And I'll use the interest rates as an example of it.
The quantity exchange rate, foreign exchange rate, plus 1, times the quantity 1 plus the current, the domestic interest rate, minus 1, should be the home interest rate. I don't want to beat this over the head too much, but what it is saying is that exchange rates are essentially nothing but a premium. Just like that P that I showed you before, the premium from before that I showed you a couple of lectures back, exchange rates are nothing but an adjustment value. They are nothing but a way to for currencies and goods to flow among countries. So, what does this say? If you were sitting in Russia, and the interest rates in the United States started to go up, and the Russians couldn't move their interest rates, you can see that the premium would do the adjustment for it. That is what we saw in that chart there at the beginning of our time today. Now, how closely does the real world hold to these equations that I've done here and all this crap that I've told you today that's a little confusing, even to me sometimes? God, you should see some semesters I've just gotten completely lost in my own blather. But the data has been collected many times by researchers, by PhD students, even by grad students doing their master's thesis. We actually do see the data points line up on the PPP line very tightly. If you do a regression analysis, I mean, it is a very clean, almost perfect 45 degree line. For developed countries. If you're talking about underdeveloped countries, second, third world, it's just a scatter plot. That's one of the ways, and it's a subtle way, that we can tell when a country is beginning to move from third world to second world status. Does that PPP line of their currency against our currency or against the euro or against another developed nation's currency, how closely does it come to a 45 degree line when you collect the data points? Yeah.
During the transitioning phase,
oh, God.
Well, I mean, would there be a cleaner line with the stronger trade partner?
Therein lies one of the issues is that we argue that free trade with these countries is the best way for them to get out of their problems. And that means that we have to bring them in and show them how to behave themselves. The problem with showing them how to behave themselves, as happened in South America and in Central America, was that that doesn't keep them from inflating their currencies to make their goods cheaper in other countries, to enhance their export industries, to help their infant industries. In other words, we get them on the path to purchasing power parity, at least relative purchasing power parity. And then we have given them all the incentive in the world to inflate their damn currency. How do they, what are the government issues that are involved in that? Unfortunately, socialism.
Because then the countries say, well, we are now socialists, we will print money for everyone and bring the poor up from poverty. A noble goal, but that creates inflation. And as that creates inflation, yeah, they're going to behave right on the PPP line, but they're also going to destroy their economy in the long run because that inflation will get worse and worse and worse until it pretty much ends the country and we have to go in there and do a military junta with some maniac right-wing dictator, and then years later, we kind of hide in the bushes and peek out, ooh, that was bad. Jeez, suey. Yeah, Allende, yeah, he was a bad guy. You put him in there. Well, you know, technically, yeah, I mean, we did send our military troops in there. But see, there's the problem is, the closer they get to behaving according to the fundamental laws, the more incentive they have to play with those laws and to use those laws to the advantage of the country. Inflate the currency. In other words, the inflation rate goes up, their goods get really cheap overseas. Their inflation rate go in the short run, printing the money drives their interest rates down. As their interest rates go down, their exports get cheaper in other countries. All those wonderful things in the short run, and then finally they just get eaten alive by hyperinflation, and then the currency collapses. As is the case, we did. We even did this ourselves in the period from about 2004. Well, really, it was before that, but about 2014 was the beginning of printing money like there was no tomorrow. We started printing it. And then we could, by 2017, we were in trouble. We cut taxes as a populist move. Well, that made our deficits even worse, so we printed a lot more money to fill the gap. And of course, as time went on, eventually, here we are. And of course, the average person says, well, it's everyone's fault right now. No, this is what was, this didn't happen instantly. This was going on. But it's just classic, it's just a classic example of what happens. Now, so why are these currencies dropping? Going back to the final story. Let's get back here to the euro. Right now, we are benefiting from mostly one factor. Relative inflation rates are moving at the same rate across the developed world. Everyone was printing money. It wasn't just us, everyone was. So that's not going to really cause the big trouble. And incomes were relatively stable. The changes in incomes were relatively stable from one country to the other. We all went through a pause and we're all growing now. So that wouldn't have been it. So the only thing that can be happening now is that we're jumping on the interest rate, clamping down the interest rates faster than other countries are. They just aren't doing it as quickly as we are. And eventually they'll catch up. And once they catch up, this decline will begin to stall out and there will be a flattening. That's the expectation that we are looking for down the road. What does that mean for forward rates, futures prices of exchange rates? If we look out for the at the front-end contract, it's pretty serious. We have their currencies are definitely have negative premiums. But if you look at the longer run, it's settling back down. So in other words, if you were to look at the futures with respect to the contract times, and here would be the spot, here would be the front end. That's what you're seeing. It's just what we would expect. For the time being, we're going to raise interest rates, so that will mean that there will be a depreciation expected in the shorter contracts on the futures for a euro. But then as the Central Bank of Europe gets its act together and starts jacking up interest rates, that will cause the recovery, and then you'll have it go into normal, a more normal situation. How could you take advantage of that if you have the money and you're willing to risk $5 million? You would simply write a contract out here and use that to buy the
this front-end contract here. You would write here, buy here. And then as this moves forward in time, that is going to become that, that'll become that, that'll become that, and you'll get a positive roll yield, so you get the hell out before it gets too serious. How many days? Typical situation like this, 60 days, and it'll start to right itself. But if we go into a war in Europe, all bets are off, but you're still going to take the damn final, even if you're over in Europe getting your ass shot. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.